We're raised on a very specific script in South Africa. Go to school, get a job, buy the house, trust the system, and eventually you'll be safe. But what if that script is actually a trap? What if the optimism that we see in the headlines is actually blinding us to a financial reality that could wipe out the middle class in the next few years? My guest today is perhaps the most controversial voice in South African finance. He's been called a pessimist, a fearmonger, a Dr. Doom, but he argues that what he's telling us is simply that he's the only one who seems willing to do the math that nobody else wants to do. Magnus Haystack is here, and today we aren't just talking about stocks and bonds. We're talking about the psychology of survival, the lies we tell ourselves about our country, and the uncomfortable decisions that you need to make right now to protect your family's future. Welcome, Magnus.
Hi, Eric. Good morning.
Always good to be talking with you. And these uncomfortable questions that we tend not to want to ask ourselves are something that we've got to do. It's a new year, 2026. We're looking ahead. And I want to start with that. I want to start with that delusion of optimism. You've been pilloried for many, many years for doing what you believe is telling the real story, whereas many others say, but you're being unpatriotic, you're being fear-mongering. What we're seeing right now in the world has got to be concerning most people. Americans are starting to use their muscle to apply their vision on the world. We in South Africa have taken completely the opposite approach. And our friends, in inverted commas, haven't stood up for a much closer ally to them in Venezuela. So if the shit hits the fan here, to put it crudely, I guess we can't expect that the cavalry would be riding in from China and Russia. So putting all of that together, putting all together your assessment of the country, of the markets and that, are you entering 2026 a little concerned?
You know, this concern of mine has been coming for a very, very long time. And in fact, if you go back in time, 20 years ago, I wrote a book on retirement planning, wherein I warned that don't believe in these fancy projections, which are pumped out in the media by the asset managers, the banks, the mortgage originators, that, you know, put away X amount for over 30 to 40 years and you can comfortably retire at the sea and living the dream life that you've always been dreaming. And we know that's rubbish because there's a lot of reasons for that. And one is the primary reason are the following. For the last 15 years, South Africa's GDP per capita has been declining. And a lot of people don't think it's an issue, but it is a big number over time. If your per capita of a country starts shrinking and declining steadily year after year, it means someone in that group of people is getting poorer or all the time. And the group of people who are retaining their wealth are having to do something extraordinary to do that. So that's the picture since 2010, 2011, which is facts. There's no disputing the facts. South Africa, the middle class is steadily becoming very, very poor. In fact, I was thinking about it in the pool this morning. After your income taxes, after your dividend taxes, after your VAT, you still have capital gains taxes. And on your death, you have a final tax of 25% or 20%. There's not much wealth or personal wealth being created by the middle class in South Africa. Now, that doesn't go down well with a lot of people, and they try and... And it's not about optimism or pessimism. It's about looking at the facts and speaking the truth to the facts. So your middle class in South Africa today, someone who earns a salary of 40 or 50,000 or even more, after living expenses, after taxes, there's not much left. Then you start saving into your retirement funds. And until the last year or two, the JSE has not given great returns on your retirement funds for various reasons. The last 2 years have made up a big chunk, so that's very nice. But property prices generally, except Cape Town, has been a disaster. Your values have been shrinking. Plus, you had a declining currency. You put that all into a pot, and you price your assets in dollars today, Alec. And if you get onto a plane to London or the USA or to Davos, which you're not going to this year, you know that their purchasing power has been decimated. And it reflects in many, many, many areas. I mean, people are battling, middle-class people, rich people are battling to pay their medical aid. So they're downgrading. They're downgrading cars. They're driving cars for longer. Our motor sales 10, 15 years ago was almost 1 million cars a year. They're now down to 400,000. It's a reflection of, pardon me, it's a reflection of that tremendous squeeze on your middle-class wealth. And for a young and upcoming family today to start building middle-class wealth is almost impossible. And because everything is against you.
I want us to take a deep dive into a number of those issues. But let's, and it's a wonderful background that you've given us, but let's just start from the basis of the braai conversation. Now, today, if you go and stand around the braai during holidays here in South Africa, people are kind of optimistic. It's the government of national unity is held. The rand has improved. It's a little bit like, you know, things are moving in the right direction. Is this a false dawn? Is this something that people are deluding themselves with? Or is there cause for optimism? Even you last year said, well, maybe I'll start looking at South Africa again. I might even start looking at buying a house in the north of the country. We've been pretty bullish about the Western Cape for a while. But you might even be looking there. As you enter 2026, how are you seeing this optimism that we hear so much of?
Look, there is a higher degree of optimism. First of all, the government of national unity seems to have calmed the markets and calmed the minds of the people. Yet you must not forget that our economy, and I saw the statistic yesterday, that our trade surplus, which suddenly rocketed in December, was not as a result of things getting better. It was as a result of imports that have dropped very sharply because the economy was so weak. So the economy itself, and you can only go according to the statistics, is still flatlining. It is actually shrinking. Manufacturing is shrinking. And we were, and I want to use the word a lucky country once again. We've had a tremendous commodity boom over the last year, 18 months, which creates the impression that things are well. But this had nothing to do with the ANC's policies or anything that they've done. It was purely on the back of the macro numbers suddenly falling into place, the dollar dropping sharply, the dollar's sharpest drop in 25 years, commodities screaming through the roof, our gold shares up 180%. Our resources stock up 60%. The stock market itself in dollar terms is up like 40 or 50%, which is tremendous. But that was as a result not of the ANC's doing. At the ANC conference just before the close of the year, the ANC was still committing itself to the National Democratic Revolution. It was the first point Ramaphosa made in his speech. Expropriation Act is still sitting there, but the economy is not showing signs of coming to life. And I can only talk what I see. And it's pointless saying, yes, it will get better and we must fast back and stomp on. I don't sing from that hymn sheet. I look at the facts. And unfortunately, there is, to answer your question, there is a probability. I'm not saying it's going to happen. One must be very careful about, we have a false dawn again. And then the economy just doesn't perform as expected. And then the money will flow out again. And it's worth noting, despite the sharp uptick in the JSE and the strengthening of the rand, the foreign investors have not been buying SA equities. They've been buying SA bonds. They're not buying our equities. And even Alan Gray, in a recent report, said they see better opportunities offshore. Morningstar says better opportunities offshore. You've got local fund managers, and no names, no petrol, are very optimistic about the local market. But that is predicated on this economic revival happening. And there's the danger that one gets it wrong. You say this, the economy is going to recover, our banks and industrials offer great value, and then it doesn't happen. So one must be very, in Afrikaans, to say, kakshutloop, with these very bullish forecast for the markets.
So let's have a look then at something that affects most people. And I mentioned this in the introduction, the South African dream. It's not just the South African dream. It's American dream. It's the British dream, anything in the Western country. You go to school, you get a good education, you get a job, you buy a house, and all will be well. But you've been saying for a long time, you buy a house anywhere other than the Western Cape, it's not a smart idea. In fact, it could be a trap because you have a big mortgage bond that sucks you in. What's your reading on that right now, especially for the new generation that are coming through, the younger people who are looking at this dream and saying, didn't seem to work that well for my father, but perhaps it'll work okay for me.
Indeed. There's been a move away from this job for life. I just have to stick to one pension fund and I'll be fine. They're actually seeing this play out in real time. So the job for life, a career, is going to be preserved for, you know, either the politicians in parliament and the state-owned operations. But for the rest of the people, you're going to have many, many jobs. And in fact, you're going to have several careers in your lifetime. Also, one picks up that many people have two or three jobs. They have sideline jobs. They have weekend jobs because they need to supplement the income to sustain that dream. Now, here comes a statement that is going to upset a lot of people. I actually got an email from someone I know very well, and she asked me the question, we have some money. Should we buy a property in Cape Town? And should we buy or a property in Johannesburg? And my answer to her was, I think the Cape Town property market has turned into a bubble. It's an absolute raging bubble. Everybody is buying little tiny apartments, hoping they're going to make a quick buck. And if you had to buy Cape Town, you had to do that 10 years ago. And whereas Johannesburg, if Helen Zille just marginally improves things in Johannesburg,
if she
I
gets
think
elected.
Johannesburg can offer far greater value. If you look rand for rand, what you're buying in Johannesburg, for instance, in the suburb that I live, Dainfern, and I've been living there for 30 years, I look at what you can buy for an amount of 6 or 7 million rand. I can buy a magnificent home on the golf course. And I've got two Willys on both sides gates, and I've got three gyms in the area, and I'm close to the airport. Take that 7 or 8 million rand, and I can buy a two-bedroom flat in Cape Town. And you know, logic just tells you this it's out of balance. And the property marketers are excellent. The estate agents are excellent. But there is going to become a glut of properties for rent on the market. And the prices at some point will hit the ceiling. And I think we're very close to that. So my advice to this lady was, I would put my money in Johannesburg right now. It's all about being a value investor, learning from the greats of like Peter Lynch or Warren Buffett. I think Cape Town is totally, totally overdone. Joburg is underdone. And that's where I would buy if I was a youngster or a young family. I can buy a magnificent house on a golf course with space. You can't get that in Cape Town for double the price.
David Shapiro yesterday was saying that he loves Joburg. He's always loved Joburg. I think we all love Joburg. There's anybody who's spent time there knows a certain vibe in the city. But he says the potholes just get worse. He says there's dams that are occurring in different areas now because a new pothole has come through, and he sees it from being a runner. As you know, Dave has run his whole life. He says problem there with water supply is now accelerating. And his concern is that maybe Joburg is past its best and is on a sliding scale. What if Helen Zille doesn't get elected? What if she is not given the vote of confidence that I guess any rational person would give her, given that the election's coming up in November? What happens then to your property investment in Johannesburg?
Yeah, obviously then that scenario is not going to play out. I predicated my statement on saying if Helen Zille can become mayor and get on control of the issues like the potholes and the lights and the corruption, it's a big ask, no question about it. But, you know, having said that, one goes down to the Western Cape and one cannot ignore the crime problem in the Cape Flats, and which has spilled over onto the highway to the airport. And over the festive season, we had many, many reports of our people being killed, being robbed, being shot, stones thrown at them. So, you know, I've got my kids in the Western Cape, and I've forbidden them to travel after dark to the airport. So they now schedule their flights to land in the middle of the day and almost, have an escort, because the road between Cape Town and the airport has now become a gauntlet of death. And that you cannot ignore. And if I say to you that in the Cape Flats over some weekend, 30 to 35 people are killed, that's a statistic that we conveniently try and hide and don't want to talk about it. But the crime problem in the Cape Town is becoming a very, very big negative. And that you cannot ignore. So you've got crime in the Cape, Joburg, you've got the mismanagement and the water and the potholes. What's happened in places like Dane Fern, for instance, most people are putting boreholes, solar panels, and they're trying to travel as little as possible. Now, that might not be always possible, but I'm just saying people adapt to the environment. So I'm questioning this property market boom in Cape Town. And I'm part of it. I started buying 2-3 years ago. What I am doing in Cape Town is buying small offices. I think that's, and I rent them out to businesses, not to individuals. So there's a nice little niche market there. But, you know, you are taking enormous risks buying property in South Africa.
Okay. Well, let's move on to a point that you raised earlier as well about retirement, and in particular, the great robbery, one might call it, of South Africans through retirement annuities. My late father-in-law used to beat this drum all the time. He said he put this money into Sanlam, he put this money into Old Mutual. So he wanted to see which of the two were going to outperform the other. And he said when he looked back over 20, 30 years, they both performed horribly. He actually lost money on the one and made only slight money on the other. So that's a real life example. And yet many South Africans are told, put it into a retirement annuity. You get tax benefits. When you retire, you're going to be okay. You can go and buy your property at the coast. What is the story about retirement annuities in particular, and something called Regulation 28 that most South Africans haven't got a clue about, but you've spoken about it a lot?
Until recently, Regulation 28 determines how the fund managers who manage your portfolio has to allocate the assets in terms of offshore, onshore, equity, property, cash. But the biggest bugbear until about 5 years ago was pension funds were only allowed to take 20% of their capital and put it offshore. Now, that was a tremendous drag on their performance at a time where offshore markets were rocketing and the South African markets were underperforming. And that then was increased from 20 to 30 and then currently 45%. So my criticisms on that was extremely valid, and most fund managers have acknowledged, you know, it should have happened much earlier. So there was a drag on your performance. Now comes the big debate in the RA and in the investors community. And I'm the camp that I say RAs are good up to a point. But you must fully understand what I don't like is the lot of advisors focus on the, you're going to save tax, the upfront tax, you're going to save tax. What they don't tell you, two things. You lose control of your money forever. You hand it over to an institution for the rest of your life. And only after the age of 55 can you get back 1/3, which is still tax-free. So there are advantages, but the rest stays with that institution. And you either have to buy an income or a pension fund, and you will be taxed on that income. So there's a tax deferral, not a tax savings. And one must be very, very careful just to rely on an RA. So personally, you know, if people have discretionary money, I will tell them, you know, your discretionary money will be far better over time than putting it into the RSA. So question that statement, you're going to save so much tax. Yes, in the short term, but you're creating a tax trap, which is waiting for you later on. And we see it now in my practice, where my clients are now retiring 65, 70, and boom, they get a nice big pension gross, but they tax fully on that income, which makes a very, very big difference. So be very, very careful. The point I'm making is you cannot simply rely only on your RA. You need a big, nice, discretionary pot of money, and you've seen how your portfolios have done. That's made massive changes to people's portfolios. Having discretionary money under your control, which can be moved in and out of asset classes when you require.
I like that, Magnus, because if we set the change, or remember, we've come into a change environment. Young people today, as you mentioned in the outset of this discussion, are going to change their jobs many times in their life. And that doesn't mean they're necessarily going to change their jobs inside a certain geographical area. They might go and work overseas for a time. We don't know what the future holds, and the future certainly has accelerated and changed. You're not working at one company for the rest of your life. Then perhaps retirement annuities were not a bad idea. But on top of that, the performance that's been delivered on retirement annuities, as you mentioned, through this Regulation 28, have actually been held back quite badly.
There was also another reason when your father-in-law started your RA, and including myself, when I my first job, I also signed up for some RAs. And my golly, the insurance industry at that time was selling these. The commission was determined by two factors, the premium plus the term. And they'd never tell people that the longer the term, the bigger the commission. So obviously, when you took out an RA, they say, oh, well, when do you want to retire, Mr. Hogg? Okay, at age 60. All right, that's a 30-year or 40-year endowment, and off you go. They just maximize their income by means of the commission. And for the first couple of years, you actually paid off the loan against your policy. And it was criminal. It was criminal. I spent many, many columns when I was at the Star and other newspapers writing about this. And eventually, the quieting just buried that practice. Nowadays, you have a better deal. You can invest in ETFs. You can invest in trusts where the fees are transparent. But let's coming back to the young people. And I often speak to the children of our clients, and we have little mini seminars. And I teach them about money, and I teach them how to. And most of them do not belong to a pension fund. Most of them, I have got several jobs. They freelance here. They do odd jobs there, and I stress the importance of creating your own pension fund. And it's quite amazing how clued up they become. And I'm not saying this lightly. I always say, subscribe to Alec Hogg's. Read as much as you can about investments. Make it a habit to learn about investments. And I've seen some, and including my young children, they've been investing for 15, 20 years. And my golly, I mean, they've got money. I never saw that kind of money until I was about 50. And they have got it at 20 and 25. But it's because of a discipline. It's because of an awareness and also the correct investment. So there is a change coming. I think that's why platforms like Easy Equities is becoming so popular. People are educating themselves. They're upskilling themselves. And then they are learning all the time. There's so much information out there. And I know many young people who have built a very nice nest egg in a very short space of time. In a previous generation, that simply did not exist.
It's interesting in that context that what Michael Dell has done in the United States, he's taken $7 billion and he has bequeathed that to 25 million school children on the basis that the money he gives them has to be invested in equities. Now, that is will be opening 25 million eyes many years before most South Africans even know that the stock market exists. And I guess, to use your point about the young people you interact with, it'll make them wealthy as well in their 20s and 30s.
Oh, absolutely. We all know the statistics, the delay of 10 years of investing money, what it costs you at the end of your life. And I think you and I maybe have the same experiences. When we did have some money, we did strange stuff with our money and thinking we know better. But by and large, the stock market especially Varsity, I'll come to that in a second, as an enormous wealth creator. And you've got to teach people about, the enormity of how much wealth it can create. And just, a comment before we run out of time on the year 2025. Now, you and I come from a media perspective over many decades where stock markets are known to be volatile and you lose a lot of money when markets crash and the media go overboard when markets do crash and they have headlines of how much trillions have been written off, blah, blah, blah. Yes, that's true. Last year, we had a melt-up market like I have not seen in 30 years. It is quite extraordinary what happened last year. Melt up means that everything made you money. Gold shares up 180%. I mean, we have the SA market up 50%. We have emerging markets up 25%. We have some of our dollar-based funds like Ranmore has given our clients 40% in dollar terms. Orbis, the Alan Gray Global Fund, 38%. Japan has given our clients 44%. South African bonds giving you 24%. It's quite extraordinary how much wealth has been created. And you could only have benefited from that wealth if you had stayed in the market, not listened to all the doom mongers. You remember in April with the Trump tariffs, guys were warning, get out of the market. That American guy who shorted the market, is it Burry? He was saying, get out of the market. There are a lot of guys saying this is a bubble of all bubbles. It just shows you how little we know and how futile forecasting the market is. And yeah, we have a market that the Wall Street record levels, Nasdaq record levels, Japan record levels, and it's just people have been rewarded handsomely by sticking to their strategies. I look, and I've been doing this over the festive period. I've been going through my clients' portfolios, and I WhatsApp them little messages, and I say, hi, Pete, or Johnny, or Dirk, or whatever. You know, you're up 40% this year. I mean, what a life change. It changes people's lives. And you can only get that in a discretionary format and not in a regulated format. So it's been a phenomenal year, and I think I might do a piece for you to say just how much wealth has been created in the last year, why this melt-up market is something that we've now experienced, except up with Bitcoiners who didn't make what they thought they were going to make. So gold shares, I mean, David Melville has been punting gold coins, but you made far more money on the shares. And you remember as journalists, when this gold market was running and we're 50, everybody had a gold analyst on the speed dial. Everybody was buying gold shares.
Nick and Goodwin.
One final point. The old Mutual Gold Fund was almost closed by our mutual 5 years ago. They almost closed it. In their wisdom, they decided, no, it's not an asset class we like. It's not an investment. And a lot of people put pressure on, please keep it open. Since they left it open, I've done some numbers. You've made about 400%. Shows you how smart our fund managers are. They got it wrong. So that old Mutual Gold Fund is now a 40 billion rand fund. They wanted to close it. 40 billion rand fund, and it gave investors 170% return last year. This shows you even the big guys, biggest and smartest guys, can get it totally wrong.
Yeah, don't know how big and smart. Oh, I mean, we know they're big, but I don't know how smart, because it was a campaign that was launched by the public to say, you don't close. It was the last gold fund. There used to be a Standard Bank gold fund as well.
There's only one left. And it shows you that all these smarty pants and very clever people got the so wrong. You know, and I looked at, just for a hobby, I looked at all the gold allocation of the big pension funds and the big equity funds and balance funds. And very few had 2 or 3% in the market. In fact, Alan Gray had a big exposure to gold, and that carried them through tremendously. And the rest of the guys, I don't know if they've written gold off, but they've been proven to be wrong.
Magnus, what about the, given that you had this melt up, as you described it, given that a lot of wealth has been created, and given that money gives you options, that's really what it's about. You can, after a certain amount of money, you can't really live that much better, but you have options. You have options on what to do with it, and perhaps instead of, I suppose, invert it. If you've got no money, then you just got to work to survive. If you do have money, then you can decide perhaps to retire early or whatever the case might be. But getting to South Africa, we've got very disturbing news today from KZN, where the party that gives the ANC-DA-INCATA alliance a majority one vote, one seat, is now moving across to MK and to the EFF. And that could, I don't know, trigger a domino effect perhaps around the country, which nobody who has a rational mind will be terribly excited about. What about that kind of thing living in this environment? Okay, so you got a bit of money, so now you have options. But in the second point, you say for those people who don't have the money, who don't have the options, how should they be viewing this future? One of survival, perhaps? One of maybe taking your punishment and finding alternative routes to building resilience?
What, we come back to our starting point about the weak economy and what it has done. The per capita declining, with the result 40% of people are unemployed or underemployed or have given up job. Now, that society over the long term, it has to pay the price somewhere along the line. And we see it in it manifests in many ways. And crime is what? We have to acknowledge a very large part of our crime rate is a result of poverty and absolute hunger. There are other reasons too. I'm not a criminologist, but you know, it's just common sense that if people are desperate and poor, they will do stuff that they normally might not do. So that's where the ANC has failed abysmally. They have not created jobs. They have not created jobs for the ordinary man. Their focus has been for many years to enrich the connected, the BEE connected, the 1,000 guys who Professor Gumede always says has got all the money. And he's right. If you look at all the SOEs and the kind of money that they make and the governments and the contractors, the coal contractors, you know, those are all based on ANC affiliation and connections, etc. So that's where the government is failing. The second part is the government of national unity is very interesting. I read a document over the festive season where it said that when the government of national unity was in the making, while all the parties were horse trading, the ANC's first choice was actually the MK. And they were going to form an alliance with the MK. Now, that could have set South Africa on a totally different path had that happened. Now, I don't know what the inner workings were, or maybe the demands from the MK were too radical. But fortunately, they then turned to the DA, and that's been a fairly acceptable arrangement, and it has calmed down the nerves. But that fear has not gone away, that the ANC can have a fight with the DA, and the ANC strikes a deal with MK or EFF, and then all bets are off, as they say. So this South Africa, the bottom line is South Africa is in certain areas, a precarious country. It's a phenomenal country in many respects that despite all these overheads of uncertainties that could happen, we still have massive investments. I look at the Beachcomber development in KwaZulu-Natal. That's a massive vote of confidence. I look at the developments down on the Cape, the Garden Route, Mossel Bay. So a lot of people are saying, to hell with it, I'm going ahead and making investments. But, you know, most of my clients still have a very, very large exposure to the offshore assets, and they're very comfortable with that. So they're living in South Africa. We've discussed this before. They don't want to emigrate from the country. It's very difficult at a certain age. In fact, it's almost impossible. So they're building up assets offshore, which has done extremely well over time. And secondly, you can invest in other parts of the world. And they're not doing it for themselves. They're doing it for their children and grandchildren. They're saying, my life is here, I'll die here, but I'm going to make sure that if my kid is a brilliant young kid, he or she may go to university in London or the UK, the United States, etc. So that's what we are. Well, that is what's happening. And as I say, depending where you come from, there is still a lot of risks in the South African environment.
Magnus, you spend a lot of time in Mauritius. What has the Mauritian government been doing right that South Africa's government hasn't? And I ask this because you know both countries very well and can give us an insight perhaps that Pretoria will listen to, given that Mauritius is also an African country.
Well, starting with the obvious things, Mauritius doesn't have exchange control. It has no exchange control. You can bring your money out, you can take it out, no questions asked, end of story. So that's a very big plus. I don't think South Africans really appreciate what foreign exchange controls does to a country. It does impact on long-term investing. It also restricts the movement of capital of individuals in quite a severe way. So they have not gone that route. They also don't have estate duty. They also don't have dividend tax. They don't have capital gains tax, although there is talk that they might introduce it for expensive properties at some point in time. They've also acknowledged that they do need foreign investment to make the economy grow, because Mauritius has got absolutely no resources. It's got beaches, it's got financial services, and so they must make it very, very attractive. And the latest figures that I've seen from Mauritius last week was they had a record inflow of foreign domestic investment from France, UK, and South Africa. So they are pro-business, pro-investment, and they don't have a lot of things that South Africa has. South Africa's BEE rules, the foreign exchange control, the crime situation, etc., I mean, makes it very difficult for countries to really commit long-term capital to South Africa. There's just a lot of uncertainty. Look at our mining industry. Our mining industry should have been pumping today, producing enormous profits and taxes for the government and for the people. Where did those mining companies go? You know the answer. They went to Canada. They went to Australia. They went to the United States. Most of our gold mining companies have left the country. They don't say it, but we know why. It's all a combination of those toxic environments that they have to operate in, with the mining rights, BEE. And just if you add up the pros and cons, you just take your money and go somewhere else. So that's where the government is fighting. It still believes us. I've been watching Davi Roert doing a couple of his special shows. You know, he said something yesterday. He says the ANC believes that they can run the business sector better than the business people themselves. And that's where they make a big mistake. And they can't. They cannot run it. And that's why Mauritius is growing, attracting a lot of South Africans. You know, here where I stay, we call it the Buddha Monaco, because it's just the South Africans wherever you go. And they're the workers. It's interesting. A lot of the go-getters in the Mauritian society and other South Africans that come here, they have to make it work. I mean, our plumber is South African. Our locksmith is South African. Our guy does our air cons is South African. They come here and they work, but what is important, they pay very, very little tax. They say, I had this discussion yesterday, a guy from Benoni, and he's now settled there, and he says, you know, I pay 10% tax, maybe 15%. The rest is mine. And in South Africa, he'll be paying 45%. And you just do the numbers, he says, I won't go back to South Africa because of the tax rate.
Sure.
Just to close off with, if you could go back to your 30-year-old self, now we were friends, we've been friends that long, and we were both very much younger. Yeah. What would you be advising your 30-year-old self with what Magnus Heistek today knows? In other words, how would your life have been different?
You know, that's a very interesting question. And, you know, I often think about it. What would I have done differently? I think what I would have done differently, I would have my investment strategy would have been far more focused, with one strategy, mostly equity stock markets. I'm guilty, like everybody, of picking up investment stompies. You hear this from your mates at the Braai, and then you buy off-plan properties, and then you buy medallions, and then you buy property syndications. And that's the secret of Warren Buffett, is he stuck to one asset class. He knew it inside out, and that was his, and he had the facts on his side. He said, my assets are in the stock market. I know it. And I think that was my big mistake. It took me a long time to understand that the stock market is the primary driver of investment growth, especially if you look at the returns one in the last 3 years. That would probably be my lesson in life. I was not focused enough. I was nibbling here, I was nibbling there. And if it doesn't work out, I sell. And that is a human trait. We try different things. And I didn't have someone to hold my hand and say, no, but you're making mistakes. This is how you do it. And the one comment I can make about Yanni Mutonis, he was my stockbroker before he left the stockbroking. And it, he called me in one day and he said, listen, let me help you. I was buying rubbish. I was buying on tips. I was selling too soon and I was holding on too late. And Yanni, over a cup of coffee, he said to me, let me tell you, this is rubbish. Let's sell it. This is the good stuff. Let's keep it. And, you know, I'll never forget that about Yanni. Yanni is at his age. He's now just bought Kuro for $7.5 billion. And Yanni made his fortune by focusing on what you know. And we all try to diversify. In fact, the more I think about it, it's a big con. Focus on the primary asset class and get to know that asset class inside and out. Get to know those companies inside and out, even if it's just 10 companies. And that's what I've been doing the last year or two. I've been focusing on about 10 US listed companies, Amazon, Meta, Alphabet, Microsoft, Amazon, etc. And I've done extremely well. But I live and breathe those 10 companies. So I think one must focus from an early age and let time and compounding make you rich, and it will.
Magnus Haystack is the founder of Brenthurst Wealth. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.